Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guests today are Derek Chollet, who is a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security in Washington, and James Goldgeiger, who is a senior fellow, or the Whitney Shepherdson Fellow, at the Council of Foreign Relations. Their new book is America Between the Wars. Derek, James, welcome to Berkeley.
Thanks for having us.
Why did you write this book?
Well, since 9/11, those who have been part of the debate about America's role in the world have had the sense that 9/11 changed everything when it comes to American foreign policy. And in obvious ways, 9/11 did change a lot of things. I mean, obviously, for the families of those lost on 9/11 and the loved ones, that it did change everything in their lives. And for everything from, the way we travel on airplanes to our conception of homeland security, it changed a lot. But what we were struck by is that how the debates we were having about America's role in the world after 9/11 were in many ways a continuation of the debates that had been occurring for the previous 12 years. And in that sense, from sort of the broad perspective of history, the more significant date still remains the mirror image of 9/11, and that's 11/9, November 9th, 1989, and the fall of the Berlin Wall, which represented sort of this opening of a new era in American foreign policy. And debates about America's role in the world that in many ways continue to this day.
And the fall of communism and the fall of the Berlin Wall really opened up a can of global worms, so to speak. And so a lot of what you're writing about is the intellectual debate that then followed from that. So, but before we go into sort of the problems that arose and have carried through to 9/11, I want to ask you, the Soviet Union falls, and there is only one superpower. What are the implications of that? Because that is very important structurally in terms of all that is to follow.
Right. Well, it has huge implications internationally as well as domestically. I mean, you start with domestically. For a lot of people, the notion was, hey, look, we did a lot and sacrificed a lot in this Cold War struggle. We spent a lot of money and resources, and of course, in major conflicts like Korea and Vietnam, lost a lot of lives in this Cold War struggle. So we deserve to take a break from dealing with international affairs, focus on the domestic economy. There was a lot of talk about a peace dividend, and a lot of people really thought we can transfer resources away from foreign policy, national security, to domestic affairs. And of course, internationally, huge implications, because it means that the U.S. is the leader, that if problems out there in the world are going to be solved, the United States has to take the lead in following them. But also, if there are disgruntled groups out there in the world, their focus is on the superpower. And so, there's a lot of attention, both good and bad, placed on the United States, and huge amounts of responsibility.
And I guess in this world, there really, and at this time that you're covering, there's no balancer for the United States. That would seem to be very important.
Right. And I think that there was a sense, among the American people and foreign policy analysts is absent that threat, that thing that we were always trying to either shadow or contain or work against. What's the purpose of our role in the world? And what should the limits of our power, or the use of our power, be? And that kind of animated the debates that we saw take place from the early part of the period that we cover in the years right after 11/9, where, as Jim was mentioning, there was a sense among many Americans that we should scale down our goals a bit around the world because we have problems here at home that we need to have taken care of. And how does it evolve throughout the decade as we grew more confident and became more engaged in so many problems around the world?
There's a point worth making, I think, namely that a hidden item in the debates, which we're going to talk about in a minute, is really answer to the question, how did we win the Cold War? That really is very important, that interpretation. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, that is very important because it really then carries forward for both Republicans and Democrats sort of, what they think caused the end of the Cold War and then how to think about the future. Certainly for the Republicans, the thought was, hey, look, we won the Cold War. We were tough. Ronald Reagan, you know, came in 1981 and vowed to, you know, restore America and build up the defense budget and pursued missile defense and basically helped, you know, shape Soviet decisions so they were forced to take a different approach to the world. And then ultimately that, you know, they basically bankrupted themselves and ended up falling out of the competition. And so there's a real premium then on, you know, how you stand up to evil and how you be tough and stress on national defense, and that that's the way that you should carry yourself in order to deal with hostile forces that are out there in the world. A lot of other folks, especially on the left, especially those focused on economic issues, looked at the way the last decade of the Cold War went and argued that, you know, what really was happening was you had the rise of globalization and the difficulty of economies like that of the Soviet Union to keep up in a world in which borders mattered less. And, you know, you couldn't have that kind of command economy and that more autarkic approach to economics. You had to engage the global economy. You had to accept the interdependence. And so really looked at sort of the collapse of the Soviet Union more as something that was really happening from within the Soviet Union and, you know, aspirations for freedom from within the Soviet Union, and less as the result of a push by the United States. And that leads you then to a very different interpretation of sort of what the role of the United States should be in world affairs. So it is very important how you see the end of the Cold War.
So let's do a kind of a listing for our audience of the problems we were confronted with, you know, as that decade progressed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, like, first and most fundamentally, there was the sort of basic question of what kind of aspiration should America have in the world at all? Mm-hmm. I mean, there was, you know, particularly in the early 1990s, there was a tremendous debate about, you know, the emphasis on domestic policy versus the emphasis on foreign policy. But then more specifically, I think what you saw throughout the decade were an emergence of problems that were considered sort of part of the new post-Cold War world, right? Problems from within states, where it was not so much, you know, the Soviet Union, communism expanding across the planet. It was states in many ways breaking down and disintegrating. I mean, we saw that certainly most horrifically probably in the Balkans, you know, in which the breakup of the former Yugoslavia created the worst bloodshed Europe had seen since the end of World War II. There was also how, you know, the United States would adjust to this new globalizing world. I mean, obviously, I think Jim's right, a lot of people saw the collapse of this communism as part of globalization. But with the United States, that brought both new opportunities and challenges in terms of how the U.S. economy was going to adjust to this globalized world. And we saw politicians debating what sort of policies should we implement, not just domestic policies in terms of educating our people and ensuring that they can be competitive as the world becomes flatter, but also on particular policies like trade, which, you know, for the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton made free trade a key part of his foreign policy. That was not uncontroversial among many of his fellow Democrats. Mm-hmm. It does not remain uncontroversial today when Democrats approach questions of free trade.
And also the problem of rogue states, basically.
Sure.
Which
right.
is a
Iran,
kind of
I mean, you know,
sure.
you've got, I mean, Iraq mm-hmm. emerges right away as a problem because, you know, there's the invasion of Kuwait in August of 1990, and the international community has to respond to that. You've got the concerns about Iran by mid-decade and the development of a nuclear program, North Korea and its own nuclear program. Terrorism emerges early. In fact, there were people forget that with the Saddam's invasion of Kuwait, there were fears about Iraqi-sponsored terrorism. Even the United States in early 1991, as the United States was preparing to go to war, it was very new for the American population, these new security measures put in place for the Super Bowl because of concern about terrorism. And the World Trade Center, the first bombing is in 1993, and then you have a series of terrorist activities. And because of the collapse of the Soviet Union and that nuclear stockpile, the fear emerges very early on in the post-Cold War about what happens if you end up with terrorists or rogue states joining with weapons of mass destruction. I mean, that you could really cause a tremendous amount of damage. But you know, as Derek said, I mean, also these, you know, globalization, the other thing that, that, you know, isn't caused by the collapse of communism but starts to become more in people's consciousness in the late 1980s is climate change. So all these new kinds of problems and, you know, concerns about diseases spreading more easily around the world, there's really this, you know, huge host of transnational concerns that, that arise, as well as, you know, in terms of countries, the rise of China starts to really confront American policymakers. What does that mean?
But before we, I walk you through this decade and hit some of the high points, I think the other item I want to put on the table is the way this debate was framed within policy circles before Clinton is elected president. And here you examine in your book two documents. One is Eagleburger's document emanating from the State Department, which is, I guess we can call it a State Department guidance document. Mm-hmm. And then the Pentagon guidance document out of Cheney's shop. Mm-hmm. In the Pentagon, which was probably drafted by Wolfowitz and his compatriots. So two very different pictures within the administration that's leaving the White House.
That's right. I mean, it was a Republican administration, a president named George Bush, who was in office in 1989 and 1993, the first, in many ways, post-Cold War president. And the last document you referred to, the document that was came out of the Pentagon in 1992, which Dick Cheney was leading as Secretary of Defense, and officials like Paul Wolfowitz and Steve Hadley and Scooter Libby were all top officials to Cheney at the time. That document was an attempt to develop a strategy for the United States that was one in which the United States was the sole superpower. Our goal was to ensure that any other country, friend or foe, would not rise to equal our power in any way. It was a strategy that sought to ensure that the United States would have sort of unfettered ability to maneuver throughout the world. It would not be constrained by anything. Now, that was that document was leaked at the time, purposefully leaked to try, because I think there are enemies within the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, against that view. So, you know, the President Bush and some of his top officials distanced themselves from the document at the time. But with the emergence of the George W. Bush administration, then 8 years later, many looked back at that document, and particularly since many of its authors returned into government and senior jobs, as a kind of Rosetta Stone to sort of show what, you know, the guide to what the George W. Bush administration was doing. And what we show in the book is that there was a rival strategy, that there was a debate going on within the first Bush administration about America's role in the world.
And before we talk about that, I want to just emphasize one point about this Pentagon guidance document. And it said, in effect, that I'm paraphrasing now, that there's one superpower.
Correct.
And that the mission of that superpower should prevent the emergence
of
a regional rival in any region of the globe.
Friend or foe. Right, absolutely.
Least that regional rival then aspire to be a global power.
Right. And then what you saw, I mean, so I think there has been a misreading of history, as what we hope our book tries to correct, that that was the sort of prevailing wisdom within the George H.W. Bush administration. And had Bush won re-election in 1992, that would have been the policy that the Republicans would have pursued. But what we show is that there was a rival school within the Bush administration. It has not been discussed until this book. That was represented by a document that Larry Eagleburger, who was the last Secretary of State for George H.W. Bush, wrote. It was a transition document, a over 20-page single-spaced strategy paper that he wrote for the Clinton administration as they were taking office. For the first time in 12 years, the Democrats were going to be in the White House. And that document represented, and the strategy represented, a very different worldview, one that was far more optimistic about the internationalism and the hopes international institutions could work, and one that acknowledged many of the problems that Jim was mentioning about this new world, the presence of transnational threats, the changing idea of security, and that it wasn't just a rival army that would be the problem, but weakening states, disease, and whatnot. And what we show in this book is that the fact that there were these two rival schools within the George H.W. Bush administration, that fight would have played itself out in a second Bush term had he won re-election. To a certain extent, it did play out as the Republicans were out of the White House throughout the 1990s, and we are still seeing that debate unfold today when we look at the John McCain campaign and the different policies that he's putting out regarding America's role in the world if he were to win president. You still see the kind of these schools still fighting it out. And what we try to show is the origins of that fight almost 12 years ago.
Now, there was something throughout the book. You have interesting items that sort of stand out when you look at them. And one of them was, and I think we should mention this for our audience, you've already talked about the way there was this concern about America turning inward. And so then Secretary of Defense Cheney, during this period, thinks about running for president. And he decides not to and goes to Dallas to run Halliburton. And I think what he sensed was this debate wasn't what resolved and that America was turning inward. That strikes me as a very important item.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, a lot of people, focus on the fact that Clinton won on it's the economy, stupid, and, wasn't focused on foreign policy, didn't think he would have to deal with foreign policy. And they forget about what was going on in the Republican Party. And the Republicans were turning inward. Mm-hmm. You had Pat Buchanan as an isolationist run a strong campaign in 1992. So for people like Dick Cheney, who felt that foreign policy was important, he was really out there not to blast the Democrats so much, but to try to get his party to take foreign policy more seriously. So he gives this speech at the end of 1993. Clinton's had a rough first year. Mm-hmm. But the speech at the 50th anniversary dinner of the American Enterprise Institute is not really about the Democrats. It's about the Republican Party. And it's saying, look, this is in large part our fault. We had this campaign in 1992. We accepted this notion that foreign policy didn't matter. We're still acting like foreign policy didn't matter. It matters. Mm-hmm. And there's a, difficult world out there, and we need to engage it, and we need to deal with it. And, he was seen as the person from the George H.W. Bush administration with the best chance to run and win the presidency in 1996 because he had come out of those years with a very strong reputation as Secretary of Defense and, was going around giving a lot of speeches and fell flat. I mean, he couldn't get any traction. Nobody was interested in his message. And so he left. And he thought he was leaving politics for good. Mm-hmm. I mean, he goes to run Halliburton and, I think he thought, most people thought, okay, well, that's the end of his political career. Mm-hmm. And didn't realize that he would be back once again after January of 2001.
You quote David Frum as saying that when the Cold War ended, the Republicans essentially lost the international component of their mm-hmm. political debate. Do you think he was right?
To a certain extent, yes. Yeah. Again, it's important to remember that there was a Republican president, who was in office when the Cold War ended, and that Republican president, George H.W. Bush, did represent a certain sort of hopeful vision for internationalism and America's role in the world.
New World Order.
He called it the New World Order, which it's important to note it was not really a New World Order. It was about making the old order, mm-hmm. the order that FDR and Truman and others had tried to help, create at the end of World War II, in which the great powers of the world could work together through institutions like the United Nations. He was hoping to make that work. I mean, George Bush had been a U.N. ambassador, the only president to have been a U.N. ambassador before. But anti-communism had been the glue that had held modern conservatism together. I mean, you could really argue that conservatism, modern conservatism, was created in the Cold War, and the rallying kind of point of it, although there were different factions within, everyone could agree on the anti-communist part. So with communism gone, that glue was gone. And that meant that that you saw conservatism and the Republican Party splinter into different factions, two of which we've mentioned, the George H.W. Bush kind of internationalist faction, the kind of Cheney nationalist, hawkish faction. You then also obviously had the Pat Buchanan wing that, I think stayed within the Republican Party throughout the 1990s, particularly on Capitol Hill as the Republicans took charge of Congress. A group of politicians who were once very proud of the fact they didn't own passports and would sort of brag about it, that America needed to be less engaged in the world. So absent communism, you saw this factionalization occur. And what we point out in the book is that after 9/11, there was some hopes among some Republicans that Islamic extremism could beat a Republicans after 9/11 in the same way that communism and the threat from communism could be to Republicans during the Cold War, and that it was the glue to hold them together. And I think that worked for a while, but what we're seeing right now unfold within the Republican Party is that the war on terror as a frame is weakening, and the Republicans are beginning to splinter in faction again.
Throughout this book, you are implying, I think, that there was this very vigorous debate, but it was often below the radar, and that one of the problems of leadership, and we see this in Clinton, is the incapacity to come up with an idea or ideas, but also to educate the public about these problems. So as you lay this landscape out for us in terms of the problems we were confronting and so on, I guess we would have to give Cheney some credit and say that, in fact, this all was happening below the radar, and it didn't seem how you could mobilize the country. And we had people like Fukuyama, who basically appears with a book, which is then swept away by a wave of ideology that, in essence, says we're beyond history. Mm-hmm. So talk a little about that, because he may not have been saying exactly what people said he was saying, but if the interpretation was correct, then there wasn't much we had to do, because
right.
the markets would do it for us.
Right. Well, that's part of the problem that you get at the end of the Cold War, and sort of this effort to make these big grand analyses, what's going on? Mm-hmm. And his is the first big one in 1989. You have, it's the end of history. Liberal democratic capitalism is won, defeated fascism and communism. There aren't going to be any rival ideologies. And, the issue is, when you see an analysis like that, well, then what's the policy prescription? Because on the one hand, you could say, well, you could just wait and everybody will become a democracy because there's no competing ideology. Or you could use it to argue, well, let's speed things up, and you should be going out there. But there wasn't an obvious policy prescription from that. And then the same with a few years later, you have a much darker vision, Sam Huntington's The Clash of Civilizations. But there again, what's the, you just gird yourself for battle against the rival civilizations? It's not really clear sort of what the specific policy prescriptions are. And this is something, as the Clinton team is trying to develop ideas for how to explain what America should be doing, now that, the old idea was, during the Cold War, was containment of the Soviet Union. Everybody understood that American foreign policy was about containment of the Soviet Union. Occasionally you'd have debate about rollback or other, but, we were doing containment. And then, okay, now what? We're not doing containment anymore. And as you mention, as we go through in the book, and I think this is one of the things that was really striking to us as we did the research, how frustrated Clinton was mm-hmm. with, constantly saying to his advisors, how come we haven't been able to come up mm-hmm. with the new bumper sticker to explain what it is we're doing in the world? Well, it's because of all the issues we were talking about earlier. It was so complex, you mm-hmm. couldn't boil it down. But it was very frustrating to him that he couldn't explain America's role in the global economy the way he had hoped. Even in his last speech as president, foreign policy speech in December 2000, it was in Nebraska, and he goes off on this riff where he's basically saying, I just never did as good a job as I had wanted to explain this. When we spoke with Robert Rubin, Clinton's Treasury Secretary, asking him about, these issues, and he said, he wishes that in 1994 they had sat down and thought, okay, let's think about a multi-year strategy for educating the American people about what's going on in the global economy. But, as we're seeing with the financial crisis today, it's pretty complicated stuff.
Yeah.
And, it's hard for anyone, even people who have a PhD in economics, to, really figure out sort of what's going on and what we need to do to respond.
At one point in the book, I think you talk about a lack of imagination, and of course, that being the case, then you don't get policy. And it's interesting, and I think this may be, you may be getting at the tragedy of the American presidency, because you refer to Clinton at some point, or he was described by the press at the time as to the case, basically. So you wait for a problem to come up, and you then come up with a solution and so on. Mm-hmm. So is this, are we looking at a structural problem here, or are you making an indictment of our leaders during this period?
I think it's less of an indictment of our leaders. It's more of, I think, what the history shows is a call to sort of live in the real world, so to speak. What animates this era is the struggle to find the replacement to containment. Mm-hmm. And, an important sort of perspective of what Jim just said in terms of the Clinton administration's inability to find that bumper sticker, that single phrase, was that its failure to do so from the Republican perspective showed that they were weak. Republicans claimed, Clinton never knew what he was doing. He was too ad hoc. It was all case by case. There was no sort of overall strategy. Serious foreign policy leaders have strategy, and that's what we're going to bring. We Republicans would bring if we were elected in 2000. And to us, that helps explain why there's been sort of this enthusiasm under the George W. Bush administration to talk about a Bush doctrine, to talk about the war on terror as the sort of all-encompassing frame to define everything that America does in the world. It's in many ways a reflection back on their view of the 1990s and the George H.W. Bush and Clinton years, where there was a failure to come up with that frame. But what we hope one of the takeaways from the book is that the reason there was a failure to find a frame is because the world was a complicated place. Mm-hmm. And because there were a lot of things going on that didn't sort of fall into neat categories. And we describe an anecdote in the book in which George Kennan, the father of containment, so the person who everyone wanted to be, right? They all wanted to come up with that one phrase like containment that would, win the sweepstakes. And everyone would quote that for the rest of their careers. Well, the Clinton administration, George Kennan was in his 90s during the 1990s. The Clinton administration asked him down to Washington from Princeton, where he lived and worked, and to get his take, father of containment, give us some advice. We're here trying to figure out what this new world's about and come up with a replacement for containment.
Graduate student seminar.
Tell us what you think. What would you do? And his advice to the Clinton team was, give up. Don't try to find that one bumper sticker. The world's too complicated a place for that. We don't have neat categories. Come up with a thoughtful paragraph or two. And I think what we hope is that as in this current environment, we're in the midst of a presidential campaign, we're trying to think, what about the Obama doctrine, what about the McCain doctrine, that when asked, both candidates say, well, it's not so much about a singular doctrine. It's about solving problems. And the world's too complex of a place, and we need more of a thoughtful paragraph or two.
I want to quote Weber here. I don't want you to start lecturing on Weber, but it struck me that when he says not ideas but material and ideal interests directly govern men's conduct, yet very frequently the world images that have been created by ideas have, like switchmen, determined the tracks along which action has been pushed by the dynamic of interest. Because in a way, you've just suggested that the policy was so complex. But the other thing is that you have interests, right, that want to go in particular directions. Do you emphasize the military instruments of power, or do you, it's a real conundrum that the politics of this is really difficult, and getting to your end state there of sort of these are the issues, let's focus on them as problems is hard, right, to say the least.
It is hard, and in terms of ideas and interests, you just mentioned the military. I mean, I think this is one of the interesting things to understand about the 90s, the effort to rethink, what is it the military is there for, and what kinds of tasks does it need to perform? You had this structure in place, all this equipment, all this personnel, to deal with the threat from this behemoth, the Soviet Union. Right, all these troops in Europe and all this, tanks and all this. And, then we're in a world, especially after we reversed the invasion of Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, where we've got all these messy problems. Mm-hmm. You know, the first big one that emerges is in 1992 with the George H.W. Bush decision to send troops to Somalia to help feed people who are suffering under famine and, you know, hundreds of thousands of lives at stake. And, you know, at first the military didn't want to do this. Like, well, no, that's not what we do. We fight and win wars. We don't do this kind of humanitarian relief. But, of course, he sends them to do it. You know, the thought is they'll go in for a little while, get the UN set up, and then they'll leave. In fact, Clinton, in spring of 1993, has a welcoming ceremony on the White House lawn. But then we get sucked back in and dragged back in, and you end up in October of 93 with the Black Hawk Down incident. And again, that, well, wait a minute, what are we doing? Why are we doing this kind of thing? But during the 90s, you really have this emergence of these kinds of problems, these humanitarian issues, wars like the one in Bosnia, where the military, you know, is reluctant in many ways in these, because it doesn't look like what they were trained to do. But once the political decision is made, no, we're going to do them, they start to adjust. It's very interesting to watch the military during those years because they start to, you know, think, okay, how do we do this? Mm-hmm. They have to have a new set of ideas. Mm-hmm. And they have to start to think about nation building. And they have to start to think about post-conflict reconstruction and stabilization. And, you know, this was very important to see. And people who are rising up through the military are going up, you know, having worked on these kinds of conflicts, mm-hmm. not sort of, you know, big war, you know, in the U.S.-Soviet rivalry. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things, you know, that's most unfortunate about the last few years, and, you know, especially since the invasion of Iraq in 2003, is that, you know, the Bush team, when they did that, they hadn't paid attention to these new ideas that were being mm-hmm. developed in the 1990s and a new role for the military. They had disdained nation building during the 2000 campaign. Mm-hmm. And had they paid more attention to those ideas, they would have been better prepared mm-hmm. for what to do after Iraq in 2003. I mean, mm-hmm. we were already trying to figure that out in the 90s and learned a lot in the 90s, but they didn't pay attention to it. So yeah. These ideas and the mesh with interest are extremely important.
One of the guests on our program a while back was Ambassador Dobbins, mm-hmm. who really carried the portfolio in all of these interventions. And when I went back and read some of his speeches and papers, what was very clear is there was an unwillingness in the Congress to institutionalize any kind of program, you know, that would put us in the business of nation building. Right. So this was the outlook of the Vulcans who came in with Bush, you know, mirrored what was the sense in the Congress, mm-hmm. basically, mm-hmm. to not build the institutions to do this. So if it's a struggle for world images, we'll talk about Clinton in a minute. But what I find intriguing is the extent to which, and I recommend your book to our audience, that the debates among the first generation neoconservatives, mm-hmm. who basically were toothless and idealists after idea-less, mm-hmm. After the fall of the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. and really are ready to close up shop. Mm-hmm. But then a new generation mm-hmm. comes. Mm-hmm. And in your book, they're embodied by Kagan mm-hmm. and William Crystal Jr., yeah. who pick up the torch, start a lobbying organization or an idea bank, really reminiscent of the committee of the present danger going back in an earlier period. Talk a little about that, because they really seized this mantle, and it was a generational change, and they had ideas about what to
yeah.
do.
Yeah, and I think first to start, as you mentioned, I mean, the classic neoconservatives, those Democrats who had left the Democratic Party in the 1970s and 80s and, you know, had become Reagan Democrats mm-hmm. on foreign policy. After the end of the Cold War, they closed up shop. You know, there was a sense that, again, they had done what they did to fight the evil empire. With the communism, you know, gone, they can go back to sort of normal business. And many of the institutions they created were, in fact, shut down because they felt as though there was no need for them, and it was hard to really find anyone in Washington in the mid-1990s who would call themselves a neoconservative, which, again, from the perspective of today, where there's a perception that kind of neoconservatives have been plotting, you know, for years and years and years, it sheds some light on this movement and sort of its origins. And as you point out, there was kind of a rebirth, so to speak, in mid-decade by thinkers like Bill Kristol and Bob Kagan. And what's interesting, when you go back to read their early writings and sort of examine their early efforts, and we talked with both of them about what, you know, they were trying to do, is that it's as much about trying to steer the Republican Party in a different direction as it is about going against the Clinton administration or beating up Democrats. And much of their early writings is a way to try to push back against the prevailing mood that they saw on Capitol Hill among the Republican Party that was in power in Congress, of to sort of drift towards isolationism. And what they were trying to do early on in particular was set an agenda of inspiration for America and the world, and saying, you know, the United States is a great power and it's a good power, and that we need to be active in the world out there solving problems and doing big things. It didn't get much traction. I mean, they tried very hard to make that kind of a rallying set of ideas for Republicans, but no one was buying. Mm-hmm. And by as the decade wore on, and by the end of the decade, you saw them grab onto the sense of threat. And instead of talking about big grand projects in the image of Teddy Roosevelt, they were talking more about threats like Iraq, threats from rogue states like Iran and North Korea, the rise of China. Mm-hmm. And that's when it sort of they started to morph more into a politically active crowd. Now, in the 2000 campaign, they didn't support George W. Bush. Most of these folks supported actually John McCain for president. And they felt them as they were very much outsiders in the George W. Bush world. And certainly for the first 7 or 8 months of Bush's administration before 9/11, they didn't feel as though they were getting much of anywhere with the Bush team. And then 9/11 occurred. And I think, you know, he and his top advisors embraced an agenda that they had been working on in a lonely fight in the 1990s.
And importantly, they some point during this period, they got the democratization bug. Is that fair? And how does that come about? Because it would seem to be a critical element in this. They had supported the humanitarian interventions. Right. I mean, they were very, very hawkish there.
That's right. Right.
Well, you know, it was sort of part of the wrapped around the end of the Cold War and the flourishing of democracy, especially in Central Eastern Europe, and this notion that, you know, I mean, for some of these neoconservatives who really stuck with neoconservatism, this notion that freedom agenda under Ronald Reagan was really an important part of what had helped cause the end of the Cold War, and that now that the Cold War was over and you had all these countries that had been under communist rule, that America could really help spread, help encourage these countries to become democracies and help encourage the spread of democracy elsewhere. And, of course, in the 1990s, you have, even if you didn't buy the whole end of history argument, I mean, there really aren't any rivals out there at the time. Mm-hmm. It does seem like everybody's looking at the United States saying, okay, well, you guys won and, you know, you have markets and democracy, and so that should be the wave, and the United States has all this power. And their argument was, you know, we can't just sit around and be realists. We've got all this power, and we have this opportunity, and countries are looking for support, and we should go ahead and really carry forward a freedom agenda. But as Derek was saying, you know, you got like 5 neoconservatives left in Washington in the mid-1990s. There's just not a lot of people interested in that argument, certainly on the Republican side. I mean, paradoxically, there was interest among people like Tony Lake, Clinton's first national security advisor, who also believed very strongly in this and, you know, had hoped, in fact, with the 1992 campaign to try to pull some of these formerly Reagan Democrats back to the Democratic Party and make democracy more central.
As you describe Clinton in the book, he seems to move from crisis to crisis. And in fact, he makes some major blunders, for example, in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. So he knows that he lost politically in Somalia because the soldiers were killed, the Black Hawk Down incident. Mm-hmm. Rwanda comes up, and The administration is totally silent. Meanwhile, he's trying, as you said, to come up with the bumper sticker idea. And in fact, in the end, an idea emerges. And I guess the one other piece that we should put on the table here that we have not raised, you mentioned Robert Rubin, that the big idea men in the Clinton administration over the two administrations became Robert Rubin and Larry Summers, who basically saw, and I'm simplifying here, but globalization, economic globalization, as key to our way of using our power in the world, and we wanted to go down that road. And Clinton lifted up and made our global economic strategy a key component of our foreign policy.
And that's something that really began in 1991. I mean, when Clinton first started running for president in 1991 and was giving speeches to sort of lay the foundation of what would be his policy agenda during that 1992 campaign, he was already then talking about the changes in the global economy and the importance of, you know, preparing the American people for those changes as well as pursuing policies that would make us more competitive. And he did seek to elevate the role of global economics in the foreign policy mm-hmm. decision-making by creating a National Economic Council within the White House, by elevating the status of his Treasury secretaries and having them have a real seat at the table of foreign policy decisions. And many of his, you know, what he considers some of his, Bill Clinton considers most important foreign policy accomplishments related to global economic issues, you know, whether it was the creation of the WTO or the bailout of Mexico when the peso plummeted in 1995, or the Treasury Department and the Clinton administration's stewardship of through the economic crisis, Asian economic crisis in 1998. I mean, this was very much part of the Clinton agenda, and I think that's something that Republicans from the outside never embraced at all. They saw this as all part of this kind of, you know, liberal, you know, baloney, right? They didn't really sort of buy it as serious foreign policy. You actually saw that reflected in the first years of the George W. Bush administration, when the Treasury Secretaries Paul O'Neill and John Snow, who many of your viewers may even forget, were ever Treasury Secretaries, had a much different profile, and Treasury sort of, you know, got itself out of the game. Now, of course, in the last few weeks, we've seen them roaring back in a big way because of this huge crisis. But it reflects kind of the perspective that Republicans had about globalization, which George W. Bush, in his early years as president, wouldn't even use the word globalization, mm-hmm. you know, because it was seen as a Clinton word, mm-hmm. something that, you know, serious foreign policy leaders didn't engage in.
And as we follow the Clinton administration, Clinton finally comes up with his grand strategy, and it's globalization, economic globalization. But in addition, we'll turn to James here for his expertise on the Soviet Union. I mean, in other words, a key thing they decided on, hey, it would be great to enlarge NATO, a security alliance whose mission is unclear, and that would be a way to spread democratization. Right. And Kennan, who was still alive then, said this was a great mistake.
Right. I mean, Kennan's called it, you know, the biggest strategic error. There were others. There were other prominent observers who also were quite opposed to NATO enlargement. The historian John Lewis Gaddis was very opposed. Columnists like Tom Friedman, who's still arguing that, you know, NATO enlargement is at the root of the current problems between the United States and Russia. But, you know, it's not as though there was sort of a well-formed strategy at the start. But what you have as the decade goes along and as the Clinton administration goes along, there is what emerges a strategy for Europe. I mean, George H.W. Bush had enunciated early in his presidency the idea of a Europe whole and free, that he would overcome communism. And, you know, that this, people forget now, of course, you know, for American foreign policy, the conflicts that had arisen in Europe, you know, were a major source of problem for the United States throughout the 20th century. I mean, World War I, World War II, and the Cold War, you know, all emerging from problems in Europe, and this notion that you could eliminate those finally with the end of the Cold War. And so You know, there was this hope that you could put all the different elements together, that you could use NATO as a tool to help encourage reform in Central and Eastern Europe, bring those countries, integrate them into the West, make it possible then for the European Union to enlarge and to, you know, really establish those countries as strongly democratic and market-oriented. But that you would also work in the other pieces of Europe, that you would pacify the Balkans, you'd end the war in Bosnia, and then later, you know, protect the population in Kosovo and deal with the repression that Slobodan Milosevic was causing from his perch as the leader of Serbia. And then you would also, the other component was to reach out to Russia and to try also to integrate Russia. And there really was a hope from the Clinton team that you could enlarge NATO, explain that it wasn't an anti-Russian organization. It was changed. It was going to deal with other kinds of threats, new threats. It was there to help stabilize Europe. And that you'd still be able to work closely with the Russians and reach out to the Russians, and that you would be able to do both of these things at the same time. And, you know, as we've seen over time, the huge success we had with NATO enlargement and the success in bringing Central and Eastern Europe into the West, and the huge, you know, I mean, the Balkans has been a little rougher, including in the aftermath of the recognition of the independence of Kosovo, but still success there as well. Those successes did cause a backlash in Russia, and Russia never accepted Europe whole and free. Mm-hmm. I mean, Russia wanted, well, no, there's your sphere of influence and there's our sphere of influence, and we don't like the fact that yours is getting bigger and bigger.
So in Georgia, we get the seed planted during this period that you're covering comes back to blossom into a new confrontation with the Soviet Union.
Yeah, because you've got, you know, again, the Russians have a different vision. Mm-hmm. Their vision is, well, no, this Europe whole and free just looks to us like an expansion of American and Western influence. Mm-hmm. We want our sphere of influence, and we're drawing a line. Mm-hmm. You know, enough's enough. You're not going any further. And, you know, again, for the United States, and especially in the Clinton years, I mean, there just was never any sense that this was an alliance that was going to be of a threat to Russia. I mean, the thought was, look, we're not doing that anymore with Russia. We got these other things that we have to deal with. That's what this organization is for. But the Russians never accepted that.
In fact, just to add to this, I mean, the Clinton administration tried very hard to include Russia in partnership with NATO. And they created new institutions within NATO in which the Russians would have a seat at the table in the Balkans, in the peacekeeping efforts in the Balkans. The Clinton administration went out of its way to try to make sure that Russia could be a part of it militarily, which was unprecedented. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that you know, there's often sort of, in reflection from now, there's sort of causal relationship. NATO enlargement means, you know, means sort of a Russia that is feeling sort of that it needs to backlash. It's interesting, you know, when the Soviet Union was collapsing, Mikhail Gorbachev, the Soviet leader, agreed with George H.W. Bush that one of the principles that should hold throughout the former Soviet space and throughout Europe is that countries can choose their own alliances. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, there's no inherent threat necessarily to the Soviet Union. And I think that still holds. And I think that's what the American, you know, policymakers, that was what was driving them. And they didn't see this as sort of a threat against Russia. They saw it as something to try to make NATO more relevant, you know, to the future world. I think without NATO enlargement, you don't see NATO today in Afghanistan, where you have an unprecedented operation where Europe and the United States are working together in a place that's far away from Europe to try to fight terrorism.
We're coming to the end of the hour, so I want to touch briefly, but this will be an argument for people to go out and buy your book, that you're about terrorism. You're saying there was an intense debate and understanding within the Clinton administration, which was not totally operationalized in the first instance when opportunities presented themselves, but also there wasn't a public, the public was not made aware about the problem. And I mean, is that a fair assessment of what you're saying?
Yeah, well, you know, we really look at this as a tragedy as you go along in these 12 years and in the run-up to September 11th, because, again, as we've been talking about, Bill Clinton understood globalization. He understood the opportunities. He also understood the challenges. He understood the positive economic side. He understood the nasty underbelly of, you know, all these new problems that would be, or problems that may have been there before, but now they were exacerbated by the free movement of people and money and, you know, all the things that you could do now that you couldn't previously. And, you know, terrorism is going on. You know, you have these incidents, the first World Trade Center bombing in 93. You have the bombing of the American barracks in Saudi Arabia in 1996. Then you have some homegrown terrorism, Oklahoma City, of course, you know, horrific bombing, and then the Atlanta Olympics. And then you have the bombing of the embassies in Kenya and Tanzania by al-Qaeda in August of 1998. And the Clinton team really understood by 1998 that this is a major threat, if not the major threat to the United States. And internally, they, you know, George Tenet, the director of the CIA, wrote a memo. We are at war. And they, you know, Clinton established this counterterrorism czar, Richard Clark, and, you know, prepared to retaliate against al-Qaeda after those bombings. We bombed the camps in Afghanistan and a pharmaceutical factory in Sudan that we thought was producing chemical weapons. But as we show, I mean, at this moment, that, you know, people at the top get it, and we really need to concentrate and get people's attention on this. You have Monica Lewinsky's testimony to the grand jury. And, you know, Clinton, I mean, Clinton describes in his memoirs that in late August of 1998, you know, he's on vacation in Martha's Vineyard alternating between planning the strikes against al-Qaeda and begging his family for forgiveness. I mean, you know, this is not a good scene. Richard Clark thought that that bombing in late August would be the first in a series. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it was the last, because there was so much thought of, wait a minute, what's this guy doing? Is this Wag the Dog? Is this a guy trying, you know, that movie, people, yeah, you know, president taking attention away from his domestic troubles by making up this foreign thing? I mean, there was a lot of skepticism. And it was just very hard to break through. We talked to Sandy Berger, Clinton's second-term national security advisor, about, you know, how come you guys didn't really make this case clear to people? And he went over to his shelf and he pulled out this huge binder and he said, look, these are all the speeches we were giving in which we were discussing terrorism. Yeah, but people weren't listening. Mm-hmm. And so that's the tragedy there. Then the reverse is true with the Bush team, because Bush comes in and he has a team that probably could have led, but he didn't get the problem. Mm-hmm. So you go from having an administration that gets it and couldn't lead to an administration that might lead, but didn't get it.
And even worse, they belittled it as sort of lumping the terrorist threat and the sort of new transnational threat within the kind of Clinton globalization stuff that, mm-hmm, you know, real presidents worried about states. They worried about Irans and Iraqs. They didn't worry about, you know, a group of guys who lived in a cave.
Mm-hmm. And if there's one can being kicked down the road throughout this decade and throughout your book, it's Iraq.
Absolutely.
And Saddam Hussein. And basically what you have is a real decision not to decide, but as the sense of the peril intensifies. And so you're essentially creating an opportunity for the next administration to misunderstand the 9/11 attack and go for Saddam, because there is this compelling demand across both parties, mm-hmm, to stop kicking the can down the road, even though the can may not have had anything to do with 9/11.
If there wasn't a can, yeah, in some, yeah, ways. I mean, as we now know. I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. What we try to say is that the frame to look at Iraq, yeah, is not 2003 to the present. It's, yeah, 1990 to the present. Yeah. And that the United States has been entangled with Iraq since the day Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in August of 1990. And George H.W. Bush made the decision to draw a line in the sand and then pursue the Persian Gulf War, and that we are approaching, as you point out, and as we point out in the book, a third Iraq handoff this January, where the first handoff was between George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, in which Bill Clinton inherited an Iraq where we were still entangled. We had Air Force pilots who were at war patrolling the no-fly zones in the north and south. We had all these Security Council resolutions we were trying to enforce throughout the decade. Bill Clinton used force 4 times against Iraq. Mm-hmm. Bill Clinton has a policy of regime change. That's the law of the land that, mm-hmm, he signs in 1998. But it's sort of a muddle-through approach. As his presidency ends in 2001, he hands it off to George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. George W. Bush this January is going to hand off an Iraq policy to either President McCain or President Obama. It must be made clear it is a far worse situation than either of the previous Iraq handoffs. But what are we, one of the points we try to make in this book is that our hope, not just, you know, because it, our hope for the country is that the next president does not hand off Iraq yet again. Mm-hmm. I mean, that the third Iraq handoff this January will be the last.
What would you like your readers to get out of this book?
Well, you know, we cover a lot of issues, we cover ideas, we cover politics. Really a sense that to understand the world we live in right now and to understand the challenges that we face going forward, that we really have to have a sense of history of the last two decades, and that America has been struggling with its role in the world, with problems like globalization, with terrorism, with all sorts. I mean, these are all things that we've been struggling with since 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall. And that, you know, I mean, that to have this perspective is critical. I mean, you know, there's so much, you know, there's a lot of anger about George W. Bush out there, you know, a lot of concern right now about the financial crisis, you know, wondering sort of where we are in Iraq, you know, how do we go forward? I mean, our view is, you know, you can't really understand the problems or think about a way forward unless you put these things into some kind of context and understand sort of how we got here. And really, especially on both the Democratic and Republican parties, sort of why where they are today is a product of the post-1989 world. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that only if you look at it that way can you understand what the debates are within those two parties and between those two parties as we enter this the height of this presidential election season.
And I just would add, it would seem that I'm struck by in the financial crisis right now how little discussion of the global elements of it are, which is actually, I think, another lesson of your book, that you think you can separate these issues and, oh, let's just turn inward if you do that with regard to the financial crisis, then you don't understand what's going on. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming to Berkeley and James Case coming back to Berkeley. Let me show our audience your book again, which I think they will want to get because there's only so much we can cover in an hour. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Appreciate it. Yeah. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.